Your new catchphrase is, I'm David and I'm lit.
That is, you know, I do say that.
From Topic and Earwolf, this is Politically Reactive. I'm W. Kamau Bell.
And I'm the voice of Hank Azaria, Hari Kundabolu.
The show where two comedians try to make sense of politics in America.
Man, I cannot wait for nuclear annihilation. Like, this mission is impossible, and it would be nice for it to be over.
Oh, it's coming to an end.
Today, we're talking about the power of the pen. We're speaking with former speechwriter for President Barack Hussein Obama, David Litt. The first time he walked into the Oval Office was to coach the president in delivering a birthday tribute to Betty White.
Dear Betty, you look so fantastic and full of energy, I can't believe you're 90 years old. In fact, I don't believe it. That's why I'm writing to ask if you will be willing to produce a copy of your long-form birth certificate.
Ah, a birth certificate joke. The joke that keeps on taking.
David has a new book about his life as a speechwriter for President Obama. It's called Thanks, Obama, My Hopey, Changey White House Years.
We're also joined by one of my favorite writers, Damon Young, the co-creator and editor-in-chief of Very Smart Brothers.
That's brother with an A.
He is a great writer, and he's going to talk to us about Pittsburgh and how to write savvy headlines. Headlines like Dotard-in-Chief calls the mothers of peaceful NFL protesters bitches. Mike Pence would not be worse than Trump because no one, God included, gives a shit about Mike Pence. And the headline that made the most waves recently, straight black men are the white people of black people.
Ooh, read the comments or don't read the comments.
Never read the comments. It's all coming up on Politically React.
Hey, Hari.
Hey, come out.
Here we are, the second to last episode of season two of Politically Reactive.
Yeah, man, but we made it this far. And I don't mean that in terms of like the podcast being canceled. I didn't really think that would happen, but just in terms of being alive. And every day since Trump got elected, you know, I think about how amazing it is that I'm still alive.
Yeah, it's like it's a gift. Every day is a gift, but it's not a great gift. It's like when your grandma gives you socks.
Yeah, but as you get older or when you lack certain other things, socks sound great.
That's true. I'm not saying it's bad, but it's just not. It's not a good. Some days socks are a great gift. Some days socks are not a great gift. And that's what what life is under President Trump. Every
Instead
day.
Of getting closer to like equality and justice, you know, we got socks.
Yeah, you just get socks. Yeah.
Yeah. I was on Major League Baseball television last week, by the way.
That was so weird.
Yeah,
I just saw pictures. I was like, oh, there's no way that went well. Did it go well?
It went fine.
Of
but
course it
I
did.
Clearly,
of course it did, because you're able to talk baseball.
I was being a fan, though. I was totally being a fan. Like, I couldn't,
had to.
I had all these things I wanted to say, and I nerded it out.
Oh, my God. But that was just, I mean, that's funny. That's your other life. That's the thing that, like, once you, the way that, like, Jim Carrey is now a painter, like, he doesn't really do movies anymore. He just paints. That's when you're retired from, like, your stand-up career. You're just going to end up, like, suddenly, like, Hari's got, like, a color commentary guy for Major League Baseball. Anyway, as this is our second-to-last episode, we want to hear from you, as we've done a couple other times this season. We want you to be a part of the last episode. And so what we're going to do is we want you to call in and tell us, what have you learned? What did you learn this season on Politically Reactive or in your life or whatever? Just, hey, what did you learn?
It would be good if you stuck to the podcast, but we're not going to restrict you.
Yeah, exactly. We don't want to stop your freedom of speech. I live in Berkeley. We believe in freedom of speech.
We're probably not going to read the ones that aren't related to the podcast, but honestly, who knows at this point?
Who knows? If they're funny enough, we probably will let them be played.
Yeah.
So call 646-389-3721. That's 646-389-3721. Again, that's 646-389-3721. I slowed it down because my mom is listening right now, and I'm sure she's like, you said it too fast. So that was for you, Mom. Also, she called in last time. I don't think we highlighted it, but we did play it in the show. My mom called in last time we did this. So in the news recently, there's a lot going on. And, you know, there's President Trump has a lot to say about the NFL. And he called every NFL player's mom a bitch.
essentially. Yeah.
I mean, not really, but it's kind of hard. You know, he said the owner should say, get that son of a bitch out of the game. I mean, basically, if you work
for the
NFL.
Whoever's kneeling, whoever's willing to take a knee, if someone's doing that on your team, he said, get that son of a bitch off the field.
As many people have pointed out, he has spent an inordinate amount of time talking about the NFL, tweeting about the NFL. I heard this morning that he's actually happy about the fact that it's ginning up so much controversy because this is how he lives. He feeds on this. And at the same time, as we all know, because we all pay attention to the news, Puerto Rico was hit by a Category 5 hurricane, which was the second hurricane that it was hit with in a week. It was hit with, or like within about 2 weeks, it was hit a little bit by Hurricane Irma, although there's not really such a thing as being hit a little bit by a hurricane, but it was hit much worse by Hurricane Maria. It's the strongest hurricane to hit the island in nearly a century. It's killed, at this point, the last time we heard, it's killed 29 people there in the region, 10 of whom were in Puerto Rico. There's reports that the island will be without power for up to 4 to 6 months. And meanwhile, the president only recently tweeted about that. I think he had like 3 or 4 tweets when we were recording this. And his tweets were basically blaming Puerto Rico for the hurricane because they're saying Puerto Rico's in debt because Puerto Rico owes a lot of money to Wall Street. Yeah. But here's a quick tip. Puerto Rico's in debt because America put Puerto Rico in debt. Like, if you want to know more about this, we did an episode of United Shades of America about Puerto Rico, and we talked about how, you know, because Puerto Rico does not have the rights of being a state, there's a lot of weird laws and weird things that can happen, and a lot of it ends up with Puerto Rico being in debt. Puerto Rico's $80 billion in debt, but a lot of it's because it's basically being used as, like, a tax shelter for people, and it was used as a place for, like, the pharmaceutical industry took advantage of Puerto Rico. And there's a weird thing called the Jones Act, where other countries can't ship things directly to Puerto Rico. They have to ship things to the continental United States, and then it ships from the continental United States to Puerto Rico, which adds a whole bunch of cost to the goods being shipped. So cars in Puerto Rico are like 40% more expensive. So we have done this to Puerto Rico. I'm not saying Puerto Rico should be a state, but I am saying that they've been screwed over.
Maybe he doesn't have any real estate there. That's what I'm assuming.
that's the problem. So the thing for me is this does hit close to home because I did go to Puerto Rico with United Shades of America. Rosa Clemente, who's been a guest on our show twice, and we've actually mentioned in the show several times, is Puerto Rican. She's from New York City, but she's a proud Boricua. And I was trying to figure out what organizations do people donate to, because a lot of people say do not donate to the Red Cross, as Rosa Clemente has said. And so she said that the place to donate to if you want to help the people on the front line, the people hardest hit, the people who are going to have the hardest time recovering, that you should go to the Hurricane Maria Community Relief and Recovery Fund. Again, the Hurricane Maria Community Relief and Recovery Fund. It's easy to remember. It's mariafund.org, MARIAFUND.org, mariafund.org.
In happier news, which is a terrible segue, but I had no idea how to get from Puerto Rico to this.
The happy news about Puerto Rico is that people are going to donate a lot of money and help Puerto Rico. That's the happy news.
How about this? In other news, The Problem with Apu, my true TV documentary, will air Sunday, November 19th at 10 p.m. Eastern. It'll be all over the country. The Problem with Apu, it's finally coming out. It's a documentary about Apu from The Simpsons, the history of representation. And it made me think about two things. One, the amount of abuse I'm definitely going to get online after this airs and how easy it is to be awful online. And I'm trying to remember all the lessons I've learned from seeing Kamau deal with this kind of shit. And the second thing it makes me think about is how representation works and how people behave in reaction to that. Now, I've gotten a lot of really weird tweets sent to me of late about me being single. Some of them are kind of mean. It's kind of bizarre. Like, my favorite is someone telling me that they told their kid not to end up alone like Hari Kondabolu. Like, that is
what?
That's a little weird. Yeah, it's a little mean.
And the kid's like, who is Hari Kondabolu?
Well, yeah, so it's just somebody being mean. And I get it. Like, you know, people want to be part of the joke, right? But let's be honest here. I'm 34. I'm handsome, I'm successful with multiple degrees, and I get to tour the world for free.
Preach!
I'm good.
Yeah.
I'm good. Like, Kamau and I played up for laughs, and, you know, Kamau is allowed to say certain things because he's one of my best friends, he's my older brother, he's my mentor, he's the first in line to have my back.
Yes.
You know, so it's a very different relationship. And even there, you know, we have enough mutual respect where if something bothers me, I tell him and we adjust it. Like, that's how that works. You're not part of the joke. This is between two very close friends. And I think about that because, you know, I joke about the single stuff. It's funny, I thought, but I don't need to put an image out there of me being desexualized or undersexed or awkward, you know, as a South Asian, because I think the Big Bang Theory takes care of that, right? We don't need more of that.
Preach!
So Kamau can say that shit because we're friends, but you cannot.
Because I think some of that is like, yes, we make fun of each other. That's the nature of testosterone. That's how it works.
But also friendship. Like,
it's
close.
Also, yeah, it's also friendship, but I think it's also like, you know, I think people get too comfortable, and I think that sometimes I feel like I do too much of that, and then it sort of encourages other people to do too much of it. So I'm aware that, like, oh, I should probably do less to sort of show people how to be in the world. Like, it just sort of like, right. Like this is so I take that responsibility too. But yeah, I hear you, and I'm glad you said it.
Thanks, man.
And there's only one more episode left, so maybe this podcast is just too beautiful to live.
Oh.
Yeah.
You're saying that the fans killed the show.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I'm taking a page out of your book. All right, so we're going to get to this episode. We have Damon Young from Very Smart Brothers on the route. And we have David Litt, author and former Obama speechwriter. I'm so excited about this next interview. I've wanted to talk to this guy for a while. I'm a big fan of his. We're talking to Damon Young. He's the co-creator and editor-in-chief of VerySmartBrothers.com.
Correction, Kamau. It's now VerySmartBrothers.TheRoot.com.
Correction, Hari. It's actually VerySmartBrothers.TheRoot.com. That's BROTHAS, Very Smart Brothers.
Correction, Kamau. I cannot comfortably say that word.
If you don't know, it's a site that I go to all the time. It has perspectives on pop culture, race, politics, and news, and it's always hilarious. Here's our conversation with Damon Young.
This interview was recorded on August 24th, 2017. Famed comedian Dave Chappelle was born on this day. He's rich, female dog.
Welcome, Damon Young.
Welcome. Welcome to Pittsburgh.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for coming to the city and inviting me.
I'm in Philadelphia right now, Damon. Is there any kind of rivalry between Pittsburgh and Philadelphia, or are they just too far apart?
Nah, yeah, it's Philly is almost like another state. We're actually closer to Buffalo, to Cincinnati, to Detroit, maybe to Toronto, than we are to Philly. And if you leave Pittsburgh, you are 5 minutes away from deliverance. Either way. Like, if you get lost and you make a couple right turns and you could go from Trader Joe's to, I don't know, Deliverance Jokes.
to Deliverance Jokes. That's plenty. We got it. Yeah. I think we all can fill in those jokes as we've all filled them in through the years. So first of all, I'd also get started. Congratulations. You just got bought, acquired, picked up.
Yeah.
You got
yeah.
called into the big leagues. I don't know how you describe it.
Yeah, I sold out. That's what you call it. We sold out VSB. Yeah. We were acquired by Univision. Mm-hmm. Univision controls the GMG sites, which used to be the Gawker media sites, but now Gizmodo Media, Deadspin, Jezebel, The Root, all of those platforms. Now also the AV Club and Onion. And now we are a part of that whole network. It's still a little surreal. Yeah. Like, this thing that we created now, one, doesn't belong to us. Two, I'm an employee of my own creation, now, which is weird.
It's alive. It's alive. Yeah.
How would you describe, Very Smart Brothers? How would you describe it for someone who's never been on the site?
It's the last time someone asked me this question on a panel, I said it's a place for niggas that read. And
that was a popular rap band in the 90s, actually.
Niggas that read. And that's... I need to work on that tagline.
Hold up, wait a minute.
Well, actually, Kamau, we're introducing a new segment today called Can I Laugh at That? Huh? Can I laugh at that?
What, Very Smart Brothers? He clearly said it's for niggas who read. What's wrong? Why can't you laugh at that?
I don't know if I can laugh at that. It was very funny, and I laughed, but I don't know if I should have laughed at that.
You just have to ask yourself one question.
Uh-huh.
Are you a nigga that reads?
See, the thing with that question come out is I can't say yes or no to it. There is no way to win with that question.
That's right.
All right, let's get back to the interview.
You know, your bigger platforms, your Slates, your Atlantic, New York Times, Washington Post, whatever, those were like the Cheesecake Factory.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have all of these different functions and these giant menus. And we were like this taco truck. And it's a taco truck that, you know, some people think these are amazing tacos. Some people may not like the tacos. But in order for us to be competitive, we have to have distinct tacos. We can't have bland food.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm hungry.
Exactly. I'll take you to Permanente Brothers. Am I saying that right?
Yeah, you're saying it right, but I'm good. I'm good. Yeah, Permanente Brothers, you know, it's funny. Every time there's an NFL game in Pittsburgh, like a national game, they always, you know, I guess between like the first and the second quarter, they do like the city montage. They show the bridges.
Yeah.
They show Point State Park. They show like some Yinzers just walking down the street doing Yinzer things, and then they'll show like a sandwich being made at Permanente Brothers. Like, oh, this is like Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
They might even show like some coal being made, like for the steel mills or whatever, coal mining. And the thing is, Permanente's is one of those things like Times Square is to New Yorkers, where you're just, you know, if you're not from the city, then yeah, that's the thing that you do. But if you're in Pittsburgh, you know, there are other places to get better food.
Oh, yeah. It's for the... And what's a Yinzer?
I also was thrown off.
Yinzer is a term for a Pittsburgher, for a certain type of Pittsburgher. It derives from the word Yinz, which is like saying you guys, like Yinz guys.
Okay, because I was like, and now what's Yinz? I was going to keep going down the... Yeah.
And that's where Yinzer comes from. And so a Pittsburgh, and it is not just a Pittsburgher, but a certain type of white Pittsburgher.
Oh, okay. All right. I was going to wonder if it was racially or like, tinged.
Yeah, it is a racially tinged thing. And you won't find as many Yinzers like where we are right now in like the center of the city. But once you go to like, I don't know, Brookline, which is, you know, a neighborhood, Morningside, Bloomfield, you'll definitely see some Yinzers there.
Would a sample sentence be, Yin's going to the Trump rally?
Yeah, that could work. That could work. You know what? Pittsburgh, it's funny. We are very conservative socially.
Yeah.
The city is a very old city. I think Allegheny County has the second oldest population in the country next to like wherever Palm Springs is, whatever county that's in.
Yeah.
But politically, it's been a pretty solidly Democratic place for as long as I've been alive and going back before then. So even though Trump won Pennsylvania, I don't think that he would have won Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
I don't think he won Pittsburgh or the Pittsburgh area.
Quick fact check. So Damon said Pittsburgh didn't vote Trump. Damon is correct. According to PolitiFact, Clinton received 75% of the Pittsburgh vote.
So what we're saying is Damon is not a liar.
You did a good job of describing the site. I think that's a good way. But like you said, you might have to come with a different elevator pitch now that you're walking through corporate headquarters. although I think I would like you to keep it that way if I have to choose.
I might get that on a T-shirt.
I think that's a good T-shirt. I feel like that's in line with the brand. I just want to read some of the headlines. Once you hear the headlines, you go, "Oh, I get it," because these are not your grandfather's headlines. So the world's 10 greatest enunciating ass Negroes ranked. It's not a regular root.com headline.
Yeah.
You know. 10 things white people don't seem to really give a fuck about. Working from home just might be that bullshit. I thought day parties were dumb and too millennial until I had one of my own. And then this is one of my favorite ones. Actually, I'm going to do these last two. One, if your pastor says racism isn't a skin problem, it's a sin problem, you need to find another church. And keep Dr. Bronner's peppermint soap away from your fuck parts. In parentheses, just trust me. Is that a good sort of swath of what goes on?
That is. Yeah, that last piece was written by one of our contributors, Alex Hardy. I think that might have actually been his first piece that he contributed on the site. Yeah. And it's like, that's like 2 years old. It's still pretty popular.
Well, the headlines make you go, wait, what is this?
Yeah.
I got to read this.
One of the things that we've had to do with VSB is reverse engineer, mm-hmm. where I guess typically you know, if you're writing something, you write the piece and then you think of the title mm-hmm. for the piece after you're done writing it. And the way that we've been able to, I guess, find a niche and kind of keep, you know, be known for a certain type of content is that I think of the title mm-hmm. often first.
Yeah.
And then think of the angle and how I actually want to construct the piece comes after.
Wow. So it's like the way a comic writes. You're thinking about the premise before you think about the content.
Yeah, because the content will come.
Yeah.
Content is, I'm not going to say it's easy, but if you've written, you know, as much as I have, and I've probably published maybe 2,000 pieces in the last 4 or 5 years, Jesus. it becomes almost like a template mm-hmm. Where you just have an idea. Like once you get that title down, you have an idea of how you're going to construct the piece. What you know, and as you start writing, then the jokes and the analogies and the references, they just come.
Mm-hmm. I read a fantastic column on your site yesterday by Erica DeValve called "I'm Proud of My Husband for Kneeling During the Anthem, But Don't Make Him a White Savior." It's a fantastic piece, and it's about Seth DeValve, the white football player from the Cleveland Browns who knelt with his teammates in solidarity and protest. And, you know, he made statements afterwards. He did it because he's trying to understand what is happening in this country and the fact that, like, he's going to have a child that doesn't look like him. And he wants to create a future, that is better for the child. And, you know, Erica is black, Seth is white. And she wrote this incredible piece just about how the media is making him into a white savior. And that's not what this is about. And you're giving my husband too much credit. And there were black players who started this movement and are still in this movement. And all the focus is on him. And Seth didn't do this for me or for a personal life. He did this for this bigger thing. And even if he wasn't married to a black woman, I believe he really would still do it. And it's just a really incredible piece. And, you know, and I was really excited. I was like, wow, they went. You know, she went to you. Is that what happened? She went to you, or did you contact her? How did you get her to write that piece on your site?
Okay, so there's a bit of a backstory with this. So our contributing editor, Natalie DeGraffenried, she hit me up on Slack or on Facebook Messenger and said that she knew the DeValves, that she went to Princeton mm-hmm. with them. And that asked me if I would be interested in all in having Erica publish a piece on the site about just, you know, this whole controversy and this whole story. And Erica actually had written this like 2,000 or 2,500 word long Facebook post, which was addressing just all of the feedback she's received from and saying basically the same thing she said in the piece. And so Natalie reached out to Erica, and Erica agreed. And then Natalie and Erica worked together, and Natalie ended up condensing it down to about 1,000 words and making it a cohesive piece instead of just this, you know, pretty long Facebook status. And that's how that ended up. So yeah, it was great that she, you know, that she allowed for us to publish that. And, you know, it's obviously a very important message because DeValve is the first NFL player mm-hmm. to kneel down, the first white NFL player to also kneel, and he is now the conversation is, I won't say it's being dominated by you know, that focus, but she's just basically saying, hey, it's great that he did it, but, you know, the focus needs to be on why they're doing it. Yeah. And the focus needs to be on the Black players who have been doing it and aren't, you know, getting the same type of recognition that he is. And on, you know, Kaepernick, who still, as of right now, is unemployed.
Yeah.
When I saw him kneel, I was like, oh, that's cool. And then when I found out he was married to a Black woman, I was like, it didn't make me give him more credit. It actually made me give him less credit.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, well, it's an inside job. Like, it's not like, I think it's what he did is great, but it was like, it changed the fact that he's married to a Black woman. Like, well, he's kind of already one of us. You know what I mean? You know?
Yeah. And Erica brought up that point in the piece. And again, she has no way of knowing whether or not he would have done this if they weren't married.
Yeah.
But she brought up the point that he is, because he's the type of person that he is, that she believes that he still would have done that.
Yeah.
Even if they weren't together.
Well, it's hard to tease that apart.
Then. Yeah, like it's impossible.
But I think he certainly gets credit for it. But yeah, it's like, it becomes a thing where like he sort of, I mean, it makes me go, where are the other players who are married to white players who are married to Black women? Because it feels like you have to do it, you know?
Or the Black players married to Black women who haven't done it.
Oh. Sounds like another VSB article coming.
That's the thing. I mean, if we, you know, there are other white NFL players married to Black women, but there are many, many more Black NFL players married to Black women. And okay, so if you're going to hold them, the white players mm-hmm. married to Black women, to that standard, so why not hold the Black players to that standard too?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and it's, I did write something about the NFL a couple weeks ago and about Kaepernick and just about the fact that, you know, I get why people are protesting and making a big deal out of his, you know, unemployment and the reaction to his protest. But with all of the fuck shit that the NFL has going on, this isn't even like a tip of iceberg. This is like a pelican standing on an iceberg. There's so much more that is boycott worthy.
Oh, yes.
Like the... You know, the whole concussion thing, the fact that they lied to, you know, the public and the players for years.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so many ex-players coming up with a CTE and mm-hmm. just damaged and destroyed bodies, and their whole like hypocrisy and completely arbitrary stances on domestic violence.
Yeah.
You know, I remember reading something a couple years ago where, you know, they make this big stink with breast cancer awareness, and they have the pink helmets and the pink socks and the pink uniforms, all the players, and only like 8% of the proceeds from that stuff actually went to breast cancer research.
Wow.
So there are, I mean, and you know, the NFL is a corporation, and you know, if you
a nonprofit corporation until recently,
and if you dig in the guts of most corporations, you're going to find, you know, stuff that, you know, it's the reason why some people who go to a meat packing plant don't eat meat. It's like, I don't want to see how this shit is made. But yeah, Kaepernick's this story is just one of many that, you know, if you want to boycott the NFL, then you could just like this, be blindfolded and just throw something at a dartboard and just pick a reason.
Non-guaranteed contracts. All right, that's the boycott.
That's another thing. It's the most dangerous out of the major professional sports. Out of the four major professional sports, it's by far the most dangerous. Has the lowest, I guess, average career, and they're the only ones without guaranteed contracts.
Yeah,
right.
So,
which means for people listening who aren't, because we don't have a ton of sports fans, it just means that like. They can sign you to a $300 billion contract, mm-hmm. and then on the first day, if you don't perform the way they want you, they cut you, and you get none of it. You mm-hmm. just get what you've already been paid for. You don't get the rest. They don't fulfill it. Yeah.
And it's also the most violent of all the major sports, so your careers are shorter, and you get longer-lasting injuries. So it really begs the question, why do people play? And secondly, maybe this was a good thing for Colin Kaepernick, because he'll be with us longer.
That's a good way of looking at it. You know, it's you know, you can't really criticize the NFL for not caring about Black people when they've shown that they don't care about people and just money. like that, you know. So you got to care about people first before you even start thinking about like black people. There are black people. So yeah, I mean, I can keep going.
Yeah.
We're in the age of Trump. Things are terrible, but you've had a good year. How does that feel?
That feels, I keep coming back to this idea of sterility and, you know, almost like this, like a Kafka-esque, like, feeling where, and yeah, it's, I do recognize that this has been a great year for me personally, and it's been a terrible year for Black America. Mm-hmm. And I also recognize that if I look at the pieces that I've written that have gotten the most traction and gotten the most comments, I'd say like 40% of them are related to Trump or politics or white peopling or just something having to do with, you know, the political nature that we're in today. So, you know, there is, I'm not going to say it's like a struggle, but it doesn't, it feels weird sometimes. Yeah. Like I can't really find a way to articulate it, but it does feel weird. And the thing is, I mean, The Root is a, you know, platform that I work for now, and their traffic has taken off. I don't know the numbers of other, you know, predominantly black spaces on internet, but I do know that this has given us so much to talk about.
Yeah.
And there was a fear that a lot of people talked about when Obama was leaving office, if this would make black media obsolete. Well, not obsolete, but less relevant because, mm-hmm. you know, we didn't have him in office, so we couldn't maybe talk about as many. There wouldn't be the same audience for like this very like unapologetic black content.
Yeah.
And I remember that fear existing, and that, you know, if anything, there's been more of a need for people to want to read a black perspective or a perspective that goes against what's coming out of Washington today. So yeah, it's been, I don't want this to continue, you know, in terms of Trump's and whatever else is going on in Washington, but I can't deny that it has been good for us.
I mean, I've been in a similar space, but I think Harry's in that space too, where it's like, oh, I'm busier than I've ever been directly because of this.
Yeah.
You know, and this podcast continued because it was supposed to end basically when Hillary was elected. You know what I mean? And mm-hmm. it was like, oh, I guess we have more work to do, you know? And there is a thing about like having to sort of feel like, and I feel like the thing is, and you're certainly doing that, is the fact that it's sort of helped your career pushes you to do better work against the thing that is sort of helping your career. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not like it's all like sneaker articles now. Like it's not like it's, you know, it's, I mean, there will be, I'm sure there are some sneaker articles and there will be more, but it's not like you're still doing the work.
Yeah. And this is a terrible, terrible analogy, which I'm saying is going to be a terrible analogy before I even say it, but it's like, let's say you're a doctor who specializes in a certain type of cancer and you want to eradicate this cancer. And then, but once the cancer is eradicated, it's like, do you still have a job? This has been like your specialty for you went to school for this, you've written papers on this, you've devoted your entire career to this.
Yeah.
And now, oh, you did your job. It worked. You came up with a cure or whatever. Yeah. And so now what do you do next? And so I want to get to that now. What do we do next point? Because again, what's happening is just so ridiculous. Mm-hmm. It takes up too much of our brain space.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this like this weird level of like cognitive dissonance and where. Okay. So remember back when he was first elected and there was this push to not normalize. Mm-hmm. Like that was the word. Don't allow this to be normalized. Mm-hmm. Do not allow this to be normal. But in order to do that, you have to devote all of your energy to what he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is that there are other things. I'm still interested in chicken wings. I'm still interested in Kyrie Irving. I'm still interested in you know, writing about Beyonce or writing about grits or whatever. These other things that I was interested in before this happened and I'm still interested in now. So you're wondering, like, you know, you don't want to be normalized. You want to continue to push back. And whenever he says something, you want to, you know, you want to write a rebuttal or talk about how ridiculous it is and whatever. But if you do that with everything he does, that's going to be all you do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, I have been, and I know a lot of the people in media have been just trying to find a balance where you're not just devoting all of your resources and attention and energy to combating that. But at the same time, is that what needs to happen?
Yeah.
In order to defeat him.
In order to put us all out of a job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you for coming by today. We really appreciate that.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, again. Thank you. Thank you for having me here in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, in Pittsburgh. Yeah. Yeah. Do you need directions out? Do I need to give you directions?
You could give me directions back home. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I'm not sure exactly how to get back to my house.
The only question I didn't ask was because you were acquired. I sort of want to imagine that it was like in the movie The Social Network, that it was that you guys had like a baller party. That it was like a whole thing where you had to like somebody had to apologize the next day. And there was like you had to sort of send out a PR person to clear up some things that happened. And you wore a bathrobe to the acquisition party.
Maybe if we were in our 20s, but I'm married with a wife and a daughter, 20-month-old daughter in Panama, has kids and a girlfriend. So it's, yeah, maybe if we were still single and you know, out there Lawrencing in the streets. We had a thing in New York a couple weeks ago where the Root brought us up and had a dinner.
Mm-hmm.
And then had like a happy hour because we're grown as fuck right now. Yeah. And that's it.
All right. Did you say Lawrencing?
Yeah.
What's that?
From Insecure, Lawrence.
Lawrence.
Maybe I should have given more context.
No.
That's the first time I ever said that. That's okay. Not like a part of my lexicon. I just said Lawrence-ing.
Oh, okay. Yeah, okay.
You
can't help but invent the new dope shit. This is how you do.
That'll be my role after Trump is gone. It's just fine titles. Like I could be. You're, you know, like a title mercenary where people just hire me to give them titles for the shit that they do.
All right. Well, thank you, man.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.
All right. So that was Damon Young, one of my favorite, if not my favorite, writers currently on the internet, soon to have a book out. Again, go to verysmartbrothers.theroot.com. That's VERSMART. VERSMARTHEROOT.com. Very smart brothers, not brothers, brothers.theroot.com. And now let's get to David Litt, author of the book Thanks Obama, My Hopey Changey White House Years. We'll be right back after we take care of some business. And some business.
All right, back to the show.
David Litt is the head writer and producer for Funny or Die's DC Bureau. But before that, he worked in the White House from 2011 to 2016, where he was a special assistant to the president and senior presidential speechwriter. David has contributed jokes to President Obama's speeches even further back since 2009. He was the lead speechwriter on 4 White House correspondence dinners. That's like the State of the Union of jokes. He has a new book about working for the president called Thanks, Obama, My Hopey Changey White House Years. It offers funny insight into everyday life in the White House, from Smokey the Cat to the crowded halls where you could easily head bump the president. Let's get him in here.
This interview was recorded on September 26, 2017. This day marks the birthday of Olivia Newton-John. I'm the one that I want. Do, 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 do. I love Greece.
Thank you for coming on the show, David.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So my first question is, how much in the time you knew President Obama did he spend talking about me?
I mean, all the time.
Okay,
all right. You'd go in there for a meeting about a speech, and it would be, you know, all W. Kamau Bell. You have to say, Mr. President.
All right.
There are priorities
here.
Yeah. Pretty much all that was it.
Okay.
That's most of the book. Yeah.
I figured, but I just wanted to make sure. I had that sneaking feeling. Sometimes when he would do speeches, I feel like he was looking directly at me, and I just wanted to make sure that was the case.
It's funny you say that, actually, because the speech that kind of got me involved in politics and got me involved in the Obama campaign, I remember that moment that he said, people who love this country can change it. And he was talking about mostly the organizers in the room, and I was watching on TV.
We are choosing hope over fear. We're choosing unity over division and sending a powerful message that change is coming to America.
I was like, he's talking to me.
Yeah.
And it was that it is something that was really special about him as a candidate, as a president, is that he could do that. And millions of people simultaneously was like, oh, he's talking only to me.
As opposed to currently, it's like, this guy's not talking to me at all.
Right. Yeah. It's like this. I think this guy hates me.
Exactly.
David, you worked with John Lovett and Jon Favreau in the Obama White House, and they have this great podcast called Pod Save America. Were you not invited?
I don't know. I mean, most of their guests now are like senators or Hillary Clinton. So I feel like if somebody is going to get Hillary Clinton or David Litt, I get upset about that. I think that crosses a line. So it's funny because it's a little bit like being a freshman and thinking about people who were seniors when you were a freshman in college. You know what I mean? I started the White House when I was 24, and they were there already. I mean, they were in. Favreau was running the meetings. Lovett was kind of providing the color commentary. And so I felt like I had that moment where I was like, these guys are pretty cool and funny and really smart. And then all of America had that moment simultaneously when they started the podcast. So it was cool to watch.
So you're still kind of the new kid.
I think so, yeah. I mean, one of the things I talk about in the book is the way that it's to some extent there were the people who were there before the Iowa caucuses and the people who were there after the Iowa caucuses, even because I was not excited about Barack Obama until he won the Iowa caucuses. I had friends and I have friends who worked in the White House with me, and they signed up when there was no way Barack Obama was going to win a primary election. He was down 20-30 points in the polls. And to some extent, I was into Barack Obama the moment he was cool. I mean, it was only after he was viable. You know, I was not like one of those people that saw it coming or that believed even when the odds were incredibly long. It was like the odds seem reasonable and now I'm in. So there was a sense, I think, of the people who were true believers, even when that was really hard, you know, that there's a comradeship that they share.
Right. They liked him when he was on an indie label.
Yeah, that's right. And I think, and totally understandably, I think there's a sense of like, we built this thing in a way that, you know, I'm really proud of what I did, the little part that I played, just as people who started in 2013 or 2015 are. But, you know, there's a sense of being there at the beginning that I think I think you'd have to talk to them. But I think my former colleagues will always have if they were there for that.
I grew up thinking that presidents just got up on stage and talked the way that people think stand-up comics just get up on stage and talk. And now I've learned that's a job. Is that a job that you wanted to have, or is that a job that speechwriters in general want to have? Or is it like the movie reviewer at the newspaper where it's like you work at the newspaper and people, you want to review movies? How does one get that job? Did you grow up being like, I want to be a speechwriter?
I definitely did not grow up wanting to be a speechwriter. I think maybe to some extent people are more aware of it now because of Rob Lowe's character on The West Wing. You know, lots of people want to be Sam Seaborn. Every so often you run into someone who wants to be Toby on The West Wing, which I find strange, but you get some Tobies. And then also because of Favreau and the speeches that he wrote and how brilliant a speaker President Obama was, and then because the podcast that they're doing now, there is this sense that being a speechwriter is a thing that you can do. I definitely didn't think about it that way. I fell into speechwriting completely by accident. When I was in college, I did a lot of reading one chapter of the book and then trying to pretend that I understood the whole book in discussion sections. And that turns out to be kind of what speechwriters do. I didn't realize that this was pre-professional at the time, but I was becoming a generalist rather than a specialist.
I think a lot of comics are jealous of Barack Obama's delivery when he delivers a joke. It is so smooth. It's kind of as if he's done it his whole life. It's very frustrating. But did he have to be coached into how he delivers a joke? Or was that completely natural? Was it he like first take, he got it?
Generally speaking, the way we worked was if he didn't really respond to a joke right away, we would take it out. Sometimes he'd ask us to change it. He'd say, like, this is pretty good, but we could, you know, it could be sharper, or maybe we could do something else. There's got to be something better we can do with this, and we'd go and rewrite it. But I knew, and everyone else who wrote jokes for the president knew, that our job was not to sell him on every joke. It was to figure out the jokes that, when he told them, they were going to come out perfectly the first time, because you don't get a dress rehearsal. One of the anecdotes that I do share in the book is about one time, though, where we did a taping. And for that, we only got two takes. You know, now I work for Funny or Die in D.C. You spend all day on a two-minute video. But this was with the president. We had 10 minutes, two takes. And the first take was okay, but not great. He missed a couple, like, he would emphasize the wrong words every now and then. You know how it sounds when somebody's reading a joke and they don't quite get what makes it funny. And I remember thinking, this could be a problem. And then the second take was like he had been practicing for days. I mean, it was really crazy. Just because I was in the room, I know that he had not rehearsed it at all. But he was able to, while he was reading it the first time, intuit, okay, here's what makes this funny. Here's the thing I need to emphasize, what I need to focus on, and I'm going to hit that and do it. And it was one of those things where that quality, I think, showed up in a lot of his other much more important decisions as president. But you saw it in the way he approached jokes.
So how much of speech writing is really just joke writing? Like, I think the thing that I'm most sort of surprised by with the whole speech writing thing is I think before I thought president speech writer is like, well, we need to know the policy. We need to know what he wants us to say. We need to make sure that we don't say something that can get taken out of context. But then every time I hear speech writers talk about speech writing, I hear a lot of talk about joke writing. Like, how much is it is one and how much is it the other?
I think joke writing is probably more fun to talk about, which is one reason why people talk about it a lot. You know, I wrote speeches on infrastructure finance or on student loan repayments, and those were much more important issues in American life than the jokes that I wrote, but they're a lot less fun to describe. So I think that's part of why you hear people talk about the jokes. But I do think that joke writing also forces you to be precise in a way that, you know, you want to get every word right when you write a speech, but it's not as important. And so joke writing also, you need to think about how somebody sounds. I had a former boss who wrote for Bill Clinton, and before that he was a cartoonist. And he told me he always knew he could write a Bill Clinton speech because he could write a parody of a Bill Clinton speech. So if you write the parody and then you dial it back by about 20%, you're a speechwriter.
So do you know how to write the parody of a Barack Obama speech?
I've never done it, but I feel like if we sat down, you know, I think any of the speechwriters probably could have. And, you know, there are moments you become very familiar with how someone sounds, sort of how they approach an argument in the same way you would need to if you were writing the satirical version of that person.
Your new catchphrase is, I'm David and I'm lit.
That is, you know, I do say that. It's funny because I don't really 100% like younger people started to say that whenever I would meet somebody or like check in somewhere, they'd be like, oh, it's lit. And I'd be like, oh, yeah. And I don't know 100% what that means.
I don't either. I'm just playing along when it happens.
I know. I think it means cool, maybe. I don't know.
Hold up. Wait a minute.
All right, grandparents out there. Here is the definition of lit. According to Urban Dictionary, lit is when something is turned up or popping.
Are we going to have to do another cutaway to explain what turned up or popping is, Kamau?
Is it going to be a cutaway inside of a cutaway?
Turned up and popping are good things.
We're going to have to inception this cutaway?
Yeah. I mean, if you were to use lit properly in a sentence, you might say, I had an enjoyable time at that party. One could say it was lit. Man, I don't know if it's just for grandparents, man.
I'll use it in the current era. Man, that Twitter war that Cardi B and Azalea Banks got into was lit.
Is that as good?
Yeah.
Or is it more like, it's happening.
Okay, Grandpa, let's go back to the show.
Let me put it this way. When I learned what Netflix and chill means by reading an article called Parents Are Finding Out What Netflix and Chill Means.
Man, I didn't know David and I were kindred spirits.
Yeah.
Are you actually good at giving speeches? Like, are you a good, what's the technical, speechifier?
I think you'd have to ask other people, but to me, some people become speechwriters because they never want to speak in public, so this is their way of speaking in public without speaking in public. For me, I like doing that sort of stuff. I mean, I did amateur stand-up when I was 15. I grew up in New York, so I was like the weird 15-year-old at the amateur night at Stand Up New York in on the Upper West Side. And I did improv in college, and I still do storytelling with The Moth, the NPR show. So I like being on stage. I like talking in front of people. But also at the same time, the trade-off that you make, and it was a very worthwhile trade-off as a speechwriter, is you're trading ownership over what you're doing for the size of the audience. I mean, if I had thoughts about America for totally understandable reasons, no one's going to want to listen to those. So I was not kind of injecting my own thoughts, but I was helping in some way President Obama and our team tell that story. And obviously that has a much bigger reach and impact than you would otherwise have.
I've heard that, like, and I've heard this from comedians, that there are comedians who also submit jokes for Barack Obama speeches. One, is that true? Or are they lying to me? do you actually get pitches?
Yeah, there definitely were. I mean, it's possible the individual comedians were lying to you if they're like, oh, yeah, that joke, I wrote that. I don't know. But we definitely had, I would say, a kind of rotating group of maybe 6 to 8 people who would send in jokes. And it was actually really helpful because most of the speech ended up being written either in-house or with former speechwriters. So like Favreau and Lovett were involved every year, even after they left the White House. And so a lot of the best jokes and also a lot of the jokes that kind of break up the monologue in a way, those came from outside.
And you're talking specifically about the White House Correspondents' Dinner.
Yeah, the Correspondents' Dinners. We didn't have people, you know, if President Obama was going to New Orleans to talk about whatever, they were dredging the port and he was going to talk about speeding up infrastructure projects and needed a good opening joke. It's not like we would reach out to Hollywood and say, we need a really good joke about New Orleans today. That would be, we'd kind of put our heads together and come up with something. But for these big dinners, especially the Correspondents' Dinner, we absolutely had outside help.
How did it feel to write that Trump joke and then have Obama deliver it? And also, when the president saw those jokes, was he like, yes, this is what I've been waiting for?
So I assume he was, but I actually didn't write those. I had started at the White House in 2011. I was there about 4 weeks when those jokes came in. So I was kind of in the cheap seats that year at the dinner, and I saw the drafts come through, but I wasn't in the meeting with the president that year. It was only the next year that I started being in the Oval Office meeting going through the jokes. And one of the things for me was watching the iterations of that draft, and it was only in one of the later drafts that I saw, oh, wait a second, they're not just like telling a Trump joke, they're really going for it.
Now, I know that he's taken some flack lately, but no one is happier, no one is prouder to put this birth certificate matter to rest than the Donald. And that's because he can finally get back to focusing on the issues that matter. Like, did we fake the moon landing? What really happened in Roswell? And where are Biggie and Tupac?
What was crazy about that moment was, at the time, Democrats and Republicans both thought that Donald Trump was a dangerous buffoon. So it was not just the Democrats laughing. Sometimes if you told a joke that was pretty political, or if the president told it at the Correspondents' Dinner, the Democrats would laugh, but the Republicans would kind of glower, like if you told a joke about Fox News or something. But with Trump at the time, everybody was like, this guy is ridiculous. And so the entire room just lost it. And that was really pretty unique at the Correspondents' Dinner, and particularly funny because some of the people who were in that room laughing at Trump in 2011 are supporting him today.
So when Oliver Stone makes the Donald Trump president movie, that's the opening scene, basically, is Barack Obama doing that joke and then Trump going, I'll show you.
Yeah, that's right. Now, my theory of it is actually less the, like, I'll show you, and more that all that Trump has ever wanted was to be Obama in that moment. Like, you have Hollywood and the media and politicians, and they all are adoring the president who is taking the piss out of a political opponent. And I think in that moment, that's all Trump has ever wanted. He just wants the elites of this country to love him, and they never have. And I think that more than anything, there was a sense of, like, if I'm the guy up there, maybe everyone will just love me automatically. And of course, that's not how that works, but you don't just get the adoration of the public by being president. Sort of the opposite.
And in fact, he decided not to show up at all.
Yeah, I think there was an irony to that, that this could have been his moment to return to the scene of his greatest humiliation and declare a triumph, but he doesn't have the goods. I mean, he got booed at the Al Smith dinner, which is like the Correspondents' Dinner, but for the campaign. I don't know if you all saw that, but he tried telling jokes. One of the punchlines of the joke was, Hillary hates Catholics.
I wasn't really sure if Hillary was going to be here tonight, because I guess you didn't send her invitation by email. Or maybe you did, and she just found out about it through the wonder of WikiLeaks. We've learned so much from WikiLeaks. For example, Hillary believes that it's vital to deceive the people by having one public policy and a totally different policy in private. That's okay. I don't know who they're angry at, Hillary. You're right. For example, here she is tonight in public pretending not to hate Catholics.
That was the punchline. This was a dinner to raise money for Catholic charities, and there were just horrified people in the room. It is hard to get booed in a room like that. But everybody, I mean, they booed him. And I think that's why he didn't show up at the Correspondents' Dinner. He knew he was not going to be well-received.
Wait, did he get booed by men of the cloth?
I don't know that, like, Cardinal Dolan was there booing. But I do think that it's like people in white tie, mostly not priests. It's mostly sort of influential New Yorkers helping the Catholic charities raise money. But it's still a group where, like, politeness is a core value for this group of people, especially at a night like that. And the idea that people felt like the only human reaction in that moment is to boo the speaker, you have to go really far to have that happen.
That's so absurd.
That's our president now.
Yeah, he's our president. So this leads me to the next question. Do you have to agree with someone politically to be their speechwriter? You know, like, you can write, like, as a joke writer, you can write jokes for comics where you don't necessarily even think they're funny, but here's some jokes. If you had to write a joke for Trump or you had to write a speech for Trump, could you do it?
I mean, I suppose if somebody literally had a gun to my head and said, you must write a speech for Trump, I'd like to think that I could do it, but I wouldn't do it. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. You have to believe in what you're principal is saying, because I'm proud that I got to help with the speech writing, but it's not the writing that I'm most proud of. It's that the speeches in some way advanced President Obama's agenda and helped him make his vision for America clear to the American people. And so I wouldn't want to do something like that for Trump. I wouldn't want to even write a joke that makes him be seen in a better light, because I don't think he deserves to be seen in a better light. So it was an interesting thing in the 2012 campaign. A lot of people were like, so if Romney wins, you'll just write speeches for Romney, right? And I was like, I don't know why you would think that, but no, I think he would fire me, and I think I would understand why.
So Trump would be reading a speech you wrote for him, and it's like, and that's why it's important you know that I'm an asshole. Hey, wait a minute.
That's right. There's like one speechwriter joke, like a joke that speechwriters tell among other speechwriters, and it ends pretty much with the speaker reading and being like, and I'm an asshole. And that would be that speech. It's not a great joke, but it makes speechwriters very happy.
Yes.
There's that famous alfalfa dinner that happens every year, right? And that's the one where basically it's like an Illuminati dinner of like Warren Buffett and some of the most powerful people in the world that I thought was secret, but somehow I know about it. Obama gave a speech at that dinner and he did poke a little bit. Can you tell us some of the things that he said?
Yeah, the first year he was there, and this was 2009, so it was before I got to the White House, but he spoke at the Alfalfa Dinner, which is a dinner that the reason it's called the Alfalfa Dinner is because apparently the alfalfa is a plant that will do anything for a drink, or at least that's what people thought in the 1870s when they named this club. And the club meets, I think it's the third Saturday in January, to coincide more or less with the birthday of Robert E. Lee. And it's basically a who's who of rich and powerful people, but it doesn't exist for any social purpose. It's the whole point is people eat a lot and they drink a lot, and that's it. And President Obama spoke there. I think every president has spoken there. But in 2009, he said, if the general were alive today, I forget the exact number, but he said something like, if General Robert E. Lee were alive today, he would be 212 years old and very confused. And which is a good line. And then he said, look to your left, look to your right. None of you have my cell phone number. And
oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, or maybe it was his email address or something like that. But the point was, he was, for a very sort of ritualized setting like that, he was basically saying, number one, think about why this club exists and what it stands for. And, that people may not see the club as sort of a tool for protecting the status quo, but it is strange that in this day and age, the most powerful people in the country celebrate Robert E. Lee's birthday. And number two, this idea of like, yeah, you think you all are great, but like, I'm the president. And that's going pretty far for that audience. And what I talk about in the book was there was a sense that I always had that we probably would never go back. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's the sense that I got. And then in 2012, we sort of had to go pay our respects just because it didn't seem like a good idea to pick a fight with the richest people in America in a post-Citizens United world right when we're running for re-election. And again, this is not like there was no strategy memo that said this, but that was the sense that I got of just this is probably why we're doing this. And then the following year, after he won, the president didn't go back to the alfalfa. He did record a video once, but that was it.
Does the book have President Obama's stamp of approval?
I don't know. So what I told him, I don't think it has a stamp of disapproval, or I wouldn't have written it.
or you wouldn't be on this planet anymore.
Right.
Yeah, that's right. No, I mean, that was, to me, I had a sense of like, you write a White House book because you think you have a story to share. But obviously, if I had told President Obama I'm working on a White House memoir and he had said, don't do that, I would have trusted his judgment over mine. But I do think what I told him that so after you leave the White House, or at least in the Obama White House after you left, you got to take what was called a departure photo. So I brought my parents and my fiance into the Oval Office a couple months after leaving. And the first thing my parents walked in and the president goes, so which of you two does he get a sense of humor from? And the answer is neither of them. Neither of my parents is funny, but both of them immediately were like, oh, that was totally me. I've never seen anything like it. It was pretty funny watching them just totally claim credit for that. But the other thing was then he said, so what are you working on? And I said, well, I'm trying to write the first ever self-deprecating White House memoir. And he did not miss a beat. He just looked at me and goes, huh, seems like a contradiction. And I was like, yeah, that's pretty fair. So I think like many moments that I write about in the book, there is like there's a kernel of truth in some of the teasing that he would say. And so I am trying to write a book, and I hope I succeeded, that is self-deprecating for a White House memoir. But at the same time, I'm proud of what we did together, and I think that comes through too.
Well, thank you, David, for stopping by Politically Reactor today. We really appreciate it.
Absolutely, David. That was fun.
And also, of course, yeah, remember to tell President Obama I said hello, because he hasn't heard from me in a while.
Well, he talks about you all the time. So
I know. I'm sure he does. Hey, Hari, what did you learn today?
Well, I learned Yinzer is a type of Pittsburgher. And Pittsburgher is what people in Pittsburgh are called, not a kind of food. Also, the word Yinzer comes from the word Yinz, which means you guys or you all. So Yinzer is a type of Pittsburgher, which is the type of white burger.
I learned that across the street at the venue I performed at later that night after I talked to Damon, that there was a statue of Stephen Foster, the composer, and at his feet is a nameless black guy playing guitar with no shoes on.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I learned that. There's an article about it on Very Smart Brothers. Check that article out.
I also learned that Pittsburgh is a hugely different city from Philadelphia. For one, they're two different cities with two different names. Also, Pittsburgh is an Appalachian city. And Damon says it's like 5 minutes from Deliverance.
Okay, first of all, you don't say the movie Deliverance. You go, it's 5 minutes from ding-a-ding-ding-ding-ding-ding-ding. That's how you pronounce that. I've learned since Very Smart Brothers was acquired by Univision that VSB has gone harder on race, racism, politics, and other issues because now the writers get to focus more of their time on actually writing instead of administrating and, like, doing dumb things that writers don't want to do. They actually get to write. Sounds beautiful.
I also learned that Damon starts his writing process with a great title, then the content follows. But he still balances making the title not clickbaity, and he's really good at coming up with headlines.
I learned that just like us, Damon is way busier in the Trump era. But just like us, he also feels like Trump takes up too much brain space. But we can't normalize him. We have to keep pushing back.
Or we could quit the show and start a basketball podcast.
Oh, we should totally do that. It's almost time for this season. There have been so many cool trades and things happening and free agent signings.
Well, that would be interesting. Hey, listeners, I would love to know which basketball teams you think should be eliminated from the NBA if they were going to lower the league. This is a discussion that Kamau and I have regularly. Which teams will be eliminated to make a better league?
And which
I have a few choices.
And also, I want to know which one of you want us to stop this podcast and start a basketball podcast. We'll count the votes up, and depending on how it goes, we'll actually do what the vote says.
Man, a basketball podcast would be fun, actually.
It would be lovely. Too bad the world is crumbling, so we can't do it.
Ah, yeah. This year's playoffs had to be suspended because of the end of the world.
This year, it turned out, it doesn't really matter what LeBron averaged in the playoffs because the world was over. LeBron still holds a press conference after the end of the world. I'm going to take my talents to the Los Angeles. Nobody cares! The world is a burning core!
Well, I don't know if LeBron James is better than Michael Jordan, because Michael Jordan is a Hall of Famer and LeBron James isn't, because the world ended before he got inducted into the Hall of Fame.
I learned from David Litt that if you can write a parody of someone's speech, then you can actually write them a real speech. Huh, that means I could write jokes for you.
I would appreciate that. I'm not against that at all, actually.
White people are demons.
Yeah!
And then you just stare for a long time.
I've written that one already, though.
Oh, yeah, you're right. I gotta get some more stuff.
I've covered my own jokes time and time again. I've done that one many times before. Different versions.
Hari, what did you learn today?
I learned that a whole crew of people submitted jokes to Obama's speeches at the correspondence dinners, which is very exciting. But also, I like the idea. Like, usually I don't like group work.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But there's something about, like, the a gathering of different minds to, like, make Obama as funny as he could be and also destroy Donald Trump at one of those dinners. There's something beautiful about, like, creative minds coming together from all over the country for that purpose.
Yeah. I learned that David would not write a joke for Trump.
Huh. No. He said he wouldn't write a joke for Trump unless a gun was put to his head.
That's true. That's so true. Which, the current era of America, that could happen.
Very possible. Yeah.
Well, it could be like,
that's very possible.
It could be like, David, either you write me a joke or I'm sending nukes to North Korea.
All right, hand me a pen. Let's do the thing. Rosie O'Donnell is.
That's funny. You just know that's a place to start.
Yeah.
Trump's like ooh, I like this one already. Keep going.
Well, that's it for today's show. Thanks to David Litt and Damon Young. To keep up with David Litt, follow him on Twitter at David Litt. That's DavidLitt. Again, we really can't have me spelling things out. Every time, I'm sure people are laughing at me because it is kind of fucking hilarious. And don't forget to pick up a copy of his new book, Thanks, Obama, My Hopey Changey White House Years. To keep up with Damon Young, follow him on Twitter
at Very Smart Bros. That's VerySmartBros.
And you can find Damon's writing at
verysmartbrothers.theroot.com.
And we'd like to remind you to call in and tell us what you've learned this season. The number is 646-389-3721. Once again, that's 646-389-3721.
And keep sending us Twitter and Facebook messages. Weirdly, me and Hari read all of them, so keep those comments and questions coming using the hashtag politicallyreactive. And go over to iTunes and just give us 5 stars. Weirdly, it helps a lot. Like, a lot.
Also, it's not too early to start thinking about holiday gifts for your friends and family. Support capitalism and us by buying all your loved ones politically reactive t-shirts. Visit podswag.com/PR or podswag.com/politicallyreactive. Yes, I did perform at the Socialism Conference this year.
And while you're thinking about the holidays, why don't you add my book to your shopping list? You can find The Awkward Thoughts of W. Kamau Bell at your favorite local bookstore or at wkamaubell.com. And it was just named one of Esquire magazine's top books of 2017. And if you're in Toronto or the Toronto area, go see me at JFL 42, Toronto's Comedy Festival. I'll be there September 29th and September 30th. I'll be doing 2 full-length stand-up shows, and I'll be hosting a political conversation that's not politically reactive because Hari couldn't stay, so he's going somewhere else. Well, I'll be on stage with a couple people that's not politically reactive, although it might as well be.
And on this end, again, The Problem with Apu drops November 19th on True TV and on the internet and all the different places you can get it, like Hulu and iTunes and whatnot. So November 19th, The Problem with Apu, the documentary, is ready. Also, I'll be touring the country and the world kind of relentlessly for the next few months. I'll be in London, England, October 10th and 11th at the Soho Theater. I'll be at the St. Louis Helium, October 19th. Iowa City, Iowa, I'll be at the Witching Hour Festival on October 20th. This is an interesting one, October 27th and 28th in Wilmington, North Carolina. I don't know anything about Wilmington, North Carolina, but what I do know is I'd like a lot of you there. Perhaps some of you who are bigger and perhaps can guard the Godhead, which is Hari Kondabolu. October 29th in Chicago, November 3rd, Boston at the Wilbur. We got Northampton, Massachusetts at Iron Horse Music Hall November 4th, and there's a ton of other shows. December 1st, Fox Theater, Oakland. December 13th, Aladdin. And here's a big one. It's a special. I can't tell you exactly why it's so special, but December 15th at the Neptune, 2 shows in Seattle. I strongly suggest you buy tickets. If there was ever a show to go to December 15th at the Neptune. You can visit HariKondabolu.com for more details, or Facebook or Twitter, or just type in Hari Comedian. There you go, on the Google.
Wow, that show in Seattle sounds like it will be a special one.
It'll be a special show.
Also, do Hari a favor and go watch the trailer for The Problem with Apu on YouTube, because people are all up in the comments and it's not going well. So go help them out.
Read the comments.
Politically Reactive is a production of Topic and distributed by Earwolf. Our executive producers are Lisa Leingang and Lital Malad. The show is produced by Tim Barnes and Laura Flynn. The show is engineered by Dan Gallucci. Thanks to Isabel Robertson for additional help this week.
For recording help this week, thanks to Alberto Hernandez at Fantasy Studios in Berkeley, TJ Liebgott at MCS Recordings in Toronto, and Earwolf Studios in New York.
And thanks, as always, to Brontez Purnell for providing music for the show. Thanks for listening to Politically Reactive.
Don't be motherfuckers.
Please.
When you work next level. When you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii.